Hello. my name is Scott Jones. I'm the director of the Electronic Frontiers Forums track at DragonCon. This panel is called The Future of Peer-to-Peer. And the future, we had one future possible scenario for peer-to-peer, and then after the Supreme Court ruling against Grokster, perhaps another future. So that may have changed things. It may have resolved some issues and created uncertainty around other issues. So our panelists here, Randall Schwartz and Annalee Newitz, will talk about this. And
your $5 comes later.
Put it on my account.
If we could start out, for our panelists, if you could just tell us a little bit about what you do and what your interest is in peer-to-peer and the Grokster case specifically.
Okay, I'll go. I guess since I'm already talking, yes. I have to disclose a few positions about my relationship to peer-to-peer, just so you know, kind of as I'm making up comments, where I'm making them up from. And it doesn't even necessarily mean that I have a consistent viewpoint about it as well, because I have conflicting rules. I'm a copyright material producer, so I'm concerned a lot about, you know, if my materials are being spread in ways that I didn't intend it to be spread, how do we have, you know, the appropriate rules and mechanisms in place to keep that from happening. But on the other side, I'm also someone who likes to watch movies and television and read other people's books and things like that. So I always have that wonderful conflict. If I do want this for free, or I want to be able to borrow my friend's book for a week and read it and give it back to him, so how do I do that? And how do we do the electronic equivalent of that? I'm also a convicted felon for a very overbroad and vague law, as we argued, but nobody agreed. So I'm, from that perspective, I'm concerned about criminalizing what would formerly have been innocent or at worst maybe a civil action sort of behavior, and having laws that just carry things a little too far. As a small business, I'm afraid of big business, so I have that sort of vector to think about in terms of my arguments against, say, the MPAA and RIAA. You know, so there's sort of my collective positions on a lot of different issues. I guess probably the best way to introduce me with respect to this conversation. But in terms of why I'm actually here talking is, I do see it to be important that, you know, that I be able to publish and share materials freely when I want to do that. And so what I see a trend towards with a lot of the last couple of years, mostly driven by the, you know, the big record and movie industries, is that there won't be this kind of mechanism around for me to do that if they keep having their way, because they think that there's no possibility for non-infringing uses. And I want to sort of, you know, toe the line here somewhere and say, let's stop this slide. So that's sort of my basic thrust on that.
We're going to have you talk more about your conviction later. I'm Annalee Newitz. I'm the policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation out in San Francisco. My position on this comes from working a lot on issues around the Grokster case at the EFF. We were co-counsel for defendants in the case, Streamcast, which was the owner of Morpheus Software. So we've been, as an organization, involved with the case since its very beginnings, about 4 years ago. And I was at the Supreme Court during the hearing. That means I slept out all night in front of the Supreme Court in order to have the exciting honor of waiting in more lines in order to sit all the way in the back of the court and listen to the justices ask actually pretty clueful questions. Despite the fact that the ruling came down in such a muddy and non-clueful way. And so I will talk a little bit about that, about what the ruling means. It was a ruling that no one really expected on either side. It did not come down, the justices did not come down really firmly in any particular way. What they wound up doing was setting up, first of all, everybody's familiar with the Grokster case, right? So I'll just quickly explain that basically what happened was about 25 entertainment companies sued The makers of Grokster and Morpheus, which were at the time two very popular file sharing programs, and basically wanted to get them on secondary liability, which means that they would be liable for the infringing activities of the people on their networks. So in other words, they built the tool, other people used it to do illegal things, but they would be liable. So you can see, just sort of playing out in your mind, how that would affect other kinds of technologies if this ruling came down saying they were liable, because it would mean that anytime you built something that people used to do illegal activities, namely infringement, you would be liable as the vendor or as the producer of that piece of software. In this case, it was software. So the case went up to the Ninth Circuit, which is the large circuit court out there in California ways, and we won. And we won, meaning the peer-to-peer companies, and we were representing one, won on the basis that under the Sony Betamax rule, which was a previous Supreme Court decision about the fact that you could use VCRs legally and that Sony could manufacture them legally despite the fact that people were using them for infringing purposes. You know, they were doing dangerous things like taping TV shows and watching them later. So at any rate, under that ruling, what the Supreme Court said back in 1984 was, if a technology has any non-infringing use, any, so this is a very powerful ruling because it's not just significant or partial non-infringing use, any non-infringing use, that piece of technology is lawful and the makers of that technology cannot be held liable for the infringing activities of the people who buy it or use it.
So if you could use a gun to open up your door?
I don't think people are using guns for infringement yet.
Okay.
but yeah, the gun argument, I don't even want to go there because a lot of people get into that, and I think it's an interesting thought experiment because, of course, under the logic of the Grokster ruling, people who make guns would be liable for the crimes of people who do things with guns, but it's not going to be applied that way, so give it up. but a lot of people hope that it will be. But anyway, so we won in the Ninth Circuit, but then it got appealed up to the Supreme Court, and that's kind of how it goes. It goes district, and then it goes to the circuit appeal, the circuit court, and then it'll go up to the Supreme Court if the Supreme Court grants you a hearing. So, and that's where things got bad. That's where there was a 9-0 ruling that vacated the Ninth Circuit ruling. And basically what the justices decided was to ignore the Betamax issue, the Sony Betamax ruling issue. So that still holds. So we still have this notion that any technology that has any non-infringing purpose is lawful and that you can't hold the company that makes it liable for what people do with it, for the infringing activities. But, and this is the scary part, and this is what we really should talk about, is the Supreme Court also came up with a new measure called the inducement measure. And what that is a way of suing a company that manufactures, in this case, peer-to-peer technology, for inducing infringement in their users. So you have to imagine that, you know, sort of the way they're portraying it, this is these sort of nasty people at Grokster sort of saying, you know, you will infringe. And then they will be held liable. And the problem is the court defined this inducement rule very, very, very broadly, very incoherently. And they're currently now basically Morpheus and Grokster are being sued under this new inducement rule because they went after Napster's users. So basically the courts are claiming now, or the entertainment companies are claiming now, that going after the users of the old Napster is tantamount to inducing infringement because all of those old Napster users were like rampant infringers. So to go after those people as customers means that you're interested in having a business model based on infringement.
Is it a priori proven though that the Napster users were infringers? they have to have that as part of their suit?
So they apparently do not, because it's already been proven that that the earlier Napster was an infringing machine based on another court ruling in the Napster case. So, and the other, now this is the part, if any of you are developers, this is something that's really scary. The other piece of that is, if you do not include technological measures in your program to prevent infringement, that can also be inducement. So in other words, you're building a peer-to-peer app or you're building some other app. If you don't include something in there affirmatively that will prevent people from sharing infringing files, that could get you sued, and then you would be liable for a lot of money because you'd then be liable for every infringing use of your technology.
Perhaps we should sue Microsoft for making IE without anything to prevent you from downloading infringing material
over HTTP. Post a file, that's an infringing use. So any web browser.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and this is the absurd degree to which this can be taken.
I was hoping you could clarify this, because I've read both these decisions and they don't make any sense to me at all. I mean, it sounds like you can sue a lumber yard if somebody mugs you with a 2x4.
Right. And so now the justices have said, you know, they've sort of anticipated this argument. And they have said, for example, I just wrote down a couple of nice chunks of the ruling. So they claim that you basically want to weigh the Sony decision with this new inducement standard. So if you're the court, you have to weigh those two things. So you have to look at, does the technology have a non-infringing use? And you weigh that with whether or not there is some kind of inducing activity taking place. So there has to be kind of a balancing. And again, I don't want to claim that this is clear or fair. I want you to see how incredibly ridiculous this is. But they do say that, and this is so nice of them, mere knowledge of the fact that people could infringe with your material or your application does not make you an inducer. So just if you know that they could, that's okay. So thought crimes are right out. You don't have to worry about that. Not yet. And also, yeah. And also, apparently, if you are just simply promoting your product, you know, offering service, you know, offering customer support and promoting it, you know, through the usual manner, that also is not inducement. However, there's this fine line, which apparently the justices had some actual clear notion in their minds that they did not convey in their ruling. And in their decision, which there's this sort of thin line between, are you promoting it for inducement or are you just promoting it for in the usual way that people promote a product? So, like I said, they're using this idea of if you go after Napster's customers, and they're using this idea that if you don't have built-in sort of, basically, if you build a product that doesn't have digital restriction management in it, digital rights management, sorry. Richard Stallman has reprogrammed my mind. So if you don't build it with DRM, basically, you know, that you may be an inducer. It should be like a little slogan.
Mm. You could be a terrorist too, apparently.
Definitely. It all leads to terrorism in the end. Anyway, that's sort of where we're at. We haven't seen any cases yet that have used this new inducement standard. So we don't know. I mean, the decision just came down on June 27th, so we're not sure how it's going to go. Both Streamcast and Grokster have been remanded to lower courts, and so those may be the first cases we're going to see where this new inducement standard is used, and we'll see what the courts do. No, I think
interrupt, please.
Please do interrupt, yeah.
Okay. So my question becomes, I mean, I work in tech support and deal a lot in network administration. And the big question then is, since if you have some of the technologies we've had for over 20 years, like NFS and Samba, now that people have broadband connections and you can pretty much, the number of hops between machines is so short that you could actually have a wide area network based off NFS where you can create a login that's constantly on anyway. Won't peer-to-peer pretty much be almost seamless soon, maybe in the next 5 years, maybe not quite yet, but soon enough? I mean, I know like at work, I have a server at home that I log into because I work at IBM, And my employer was like, well, yeah, you have your own AI Xbox, but if you bring it in, we keep it. No, I paid $50 for it, that's mine. So I just log into it from home to do tests with the software. If those sorts of aspects start to become prominent, won't this lead to, at least the good side of it, of maybe big business being annoyed with it? Like if Sun says, hey, wait a minute, we're built on NFS, you try to mess with us, well, we'll go bankrupt, but we'll let somebody else go and do this. But doesn't it kind of impinge on getting bigger players involved on the other side, you know, the hardware people?
That's what happened with Betamax. You know, they sued Sony. That's where the decision came from. That's why all the people who've been sued so far, sorry. That's why it's a. We need a large player to step in on the side of the peer-to-peer networks, and there's nobody yet. I mean, do you know who that might be? Any idea?
The problem is who, what large
Verizon,
company?
Intel?
Yeah.
They did file amicus briefs on our behalf in the case. So, and you didn't hear this, but maybe Verizon. I mean, but you didn't hear me say that.
This is being recorded.
Something that sounds like Verizon.
Can you cut that part out?
Schmerheisen. Something sounds like Schmerheisen.
But actually, I mean, but seriously, I mean, I actually don't have any knowledge of whether Verizon would step up to the plate, but I think that's the kind of company that you might see stepping up. But the thing is again, the thing that's tricky is the big players are going to have the Sony ruling on their side. Because especially if we're talking about technologies or file systems or whatever that have been used for a long time in a non-infringing or largely non-infringing manner, in a court case, you would just say, well, look, I mean, we have 20 years of using this technology. You know, it's never been, you know, used to induce infringement. It's not even going to be a case, really. What we're talking about here is something that's even more pernicious than shutting down sort of older technologies. Really, what we're seeing is a ruling that's going to keep new technologies from developing. And I think that's really going to be the pressure point is, you know, the bigger players are going to have the legal power and the money to fight this stuff. It would be great if a big company would step up and try to challenge this decision, and we may see something like that happen. But I think instead what we're going to have is a dramatic chilling effect on innovation. Because if I'm trying to develop an application that could have some kind of infringing use, I'm going to be scared shitless. I'm going to say, well, how am I going to develop this without getting sued out of existence?
It's going to be interesting. I think probably the closest technology that would fit your description is the Apple's formerly Rendezvous, now Bonjour facility that permits you to share, for example, iTunes music list back and forth. And, you know, I imagine there's some way even to steal the songs through there. I haven't found it yet. But, you know, so that could be interesting because that's real new technology. It was specifically brought about to share. And in that case, Apple better have the deep pockets the first time somebody brings it against them.
And actually, I mean, it's good that you brought that up. It was funny to hear one of the Supreme Court justices actually ask about the iPod in court, which is sort of funny. It's like the first time ever that the word iPod has probably been used in the Supreme Court. But actually, there have been some pretty specific statements made about Apple's business model on both sides. And apparently, the justices don't anticipate this inducement measure being used against Apple because Apple has a well-established model of non-infringing use. And in fact, entertainment companies are saying this. So I it doesn't make sense to me. I think it's arbitrary and I think it's because well, this ruling, just to clarify, this ruling goes beyond peer-to-peer. This will apply to any technology. I think that that's right. I mean, I think that this is a ruling that will really stymie innovation, particularly the kind of innovation that's given us all of our favorite technologies, like garage-type innovation, people who don't have a zillion lawyers helping them out.
Apparently, Apple is scared, though, because they just ramped up their DRM.
Yeah, actually, that's true. No, I'm not saying that they are not concerned because they are. Several entertainment companies have discussed the fact that they don't see this in particular, like the iPod in particular, as being a problem. However, at the EFF, we had a whole theory, actually, and we released a fake legal complaint about the iPod being an infringing device. And we talked about how the fact that if you sell something with a 40 gig hard drive, how can you, you know, that is clearly inducement, because who owns a music collection that big? It's obviously inducement. A legal music collection that big, all lawful? All right, he's the guy.
I've got one more question. I've heard that Microsoft is making a push with hardware manufacturers to embed DRM in hardware.
Yeah.
I don't know any of the details of how they would actually do this, but apparently then, if you're trying to play an MP3 file that doesn't have the right DRM okay copyright thing on it, then your CPU just won't let you do it. And so if they're successful in that, do you think that would make all of these issues kind of a moot point? Like then it would all be done and you can't do file sharing anymore because your computer won't play it?
No, because lucky for us, well, do you want to answer that at all, or?
You start.
Okay, I would say, the issue of trusted computing, which is basically what you're talking about with the Microsoft stuff or TPMs, I think that what that will mean is that it will be harder for average consumers to infringe, certainly, and it's going to create a lot of consumer lock-in to particular kinds of products. But I think that, as I was saying earlier, lucky for us, there's lots and lots of really brilliant free software developers who are always going to provide us with alternate platforms.
But at what legal cost?
At what legal cost is the question. And also, I think even more relevant is, you know, who really will use that stuff? It's going to be, you know, people like me or maybe the people in this room who actually don't run Windows or who have the know-how to understand the dark place known as the command line.
Dark. Mine's very bright.
I've just heard people describe it as the dark place. All right, okay, I'm going to stop with that joke. Jeez.
Have more than one button on your mouse, too.
I know, it's all very terrible. But I think that generally for average consumers, I think that the sort of trusted computing platform stuff coming at the same time as this inducement ruling is really shutting down a lot of possibilities for having media that you can play across your devices. I think that is absolutely true, that it's going to make it harder and harder.
You know, I think this will be comparable, and I think that it would be interesting to look at this in terms of the fact that, you know, that this piece of hardware inside the Intel chip that permits DRM to be at the chip level maybe reverse engineered by some smart guy out there,
hopefully
in some third world country that doesn't have any computer laws.
Or Norway.
Like Norway. But I think you're heading where I'm heading with this, which is, you know, if DECSS had not come out so that we could play DVDs on our Linux boxes, if it could not come out ever, we would have problems. Because then we're locked into a vendor controlling the entire industry. It's the same thing problem we have with, you know, the DVD player itself, you know. So I would be scared that that's going to lock down that kind of innovation. And suppose that in order to have a peer-to-peer network, you have to have DRM. There's no way to do it without it. That means, again, I could not be an independent publisher and have independent subscribers using the same peer-to-peer software because I'm not going to put the DRM in it. I don't care who copies my stuff.
That's right, yeah.
Not in the sense of packet, but like, if you are a DRM person producing DRM-based content, can you make it so, oh yeah, and the encryption key is 4?
Maybe, I don't know. It depends on how this turns out.
Well, okay, but let me tell you something about our friend, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, circumventing copy protection is unlawful. Even if all you have to do is type the number 4, it's unlawful. So you're breaking the law by circumventing, even if the copy protection is shit.
And telling other people how to do it.
And telling other people how to do it, exactly.
How is that an expansion of how it was previously?
That's not an expansion.
It still sucks.
It's just the same old thing. He was saying, can't you create really bad DRM? And I'm saying DRM, which is copy protection, itself protected under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
The change, though, is that the Grokster ruling gives a complex extension of that, in that, okay, so before you couldn't reverse engineer DRM, now you can't have peer-to-peer without DRM. So between the two of those, now you effectively kill peer-to-peer.
I had read the decision by the Supreme Court, and I was actually surprised as I was reading the summary and discovered their decision. And as I read deeper, I became less surprised as I read one of the items of evidence that they presented, which was the marketing tools that Grokster and Morpheus had both presented. I think they had said that they were in either prototype marketing ideas, campaigns that they had presented. They're fairly damning when you read them. I mean, they really almost say, hey, you're stealing movies, that's cool, come do it on our system.
Kind of like the Rip Mix Burn campaign?
Yeah, it was very kind of, you know, I sort of lost support for them there, and I wanted to know, where did, you know, in your discovery and everything, when in defending them, you know, what was your feeling about that, about how much the marketing tools should have weighed? Because that really felt like, as the decision went from the point where they mentioned that evidence on, that's what they relied on, was those marketing tools that they had either created or were creating or were just a poster board in somebody's office in a corner that had just been, you know, written on it and somebody put a big X on it and said, no way, we can't do this. Whether it was a prototype or not, or something that they were actually thinking about doing, do you think that was a huge amount of weight on the court to basically say, look, these people, their goal is to steal. That's they want to tell people to steal. This is what they're saying. So do you think that was really big, or was that?
It was a big part of the prosecution's argument. There's two issues at stake in the case, right? There's the larger issue of reforming the law, which they did, which is to create this new standard of inducement. And then there's the second issue, which is much more cloudy, which is did Streamcast and Grokster engage in fraudulent business practices or undermining other businesses? You know, were they bad businesses? And that's a separate issue, and that's being tried right now. And you know, regardless of what we thought about their business practices, which I agree, you know, I don't think anybody is under the illusion that Streamcast or Grokster are great guys or that they're running businesses that we'd like to run ourselves. But what we wanted to do was create good law for everybody, for anyone, any innovator, any small business that wants to create software that allows people to share media or that allows people to share information. So we were concerned with the sort of big picture issue. And in fact, we are no longer representing Streamcast at this point, now that they've gone down to the lower court and they're actually deciding those issues of whether their business model was problematic or not, shall we say. So we were interested not in their specific businesses, but instead the larger issues that it raised about whether a company that was doing peer-to-peer should be allowed to continue doing it as long as their software had non-infringing uses. And that was where that was what we were disappointed in, was when the court said, actually, we're going to come up with this inducement model, which goes way beyond simply determining whether a business is unfair, and in fact, you know, kind of puts the lid on a whole branch of innovation. So I think that kind of answers your question, yeah.
The big picture.
Yes.
Well, it would seem to me the bigger picture beyond that is the fact you've already let the genie out of the bottle. There's not a single bit of software out there that you can't find some form of hack, some form of method to get around it from a single user perspective. I go on the internet plenty of times, cell phones, DVD players, all that. They all have hidden menus, hidden access platforms, and you can modify them and do whatever you want.
Now,
these are little cost option features that some of these manufacturers may offer. The thing is, you know, besides these lawsuits being major nuisances, how can they really affect any kind of prevention of innovation? You're going to have it. It's going to press forward one way or the other, whether it's out in the open in light of day or in the dark. How do they expect to accomplish any kind of true law that's enforceable?
But some of those menus are there because there's probably no liability to the guy at the company that left that debug code in. When something like this gets in place, then even that company and that guy can go down for it. That when it starts getting at that level, you won't have these hacks anymore. It'll be so deep in the chip, so wired down, that the guy that's on the inside that wants to let us have those hacks won't be able to do it because it's a circumvention of something that's now very obviously infringing.
even if he's doing it from the sanctity of his own home or
no, some of that, but some of that stuff had to be the device because somebody at the factory let it still work. It didn't go out the door with nobody at the factory doing that. Somebody at the factory left that menu in. And so that's the kind of devices we're going to have to, that will go away. Right? Am I on track?
I think that that's right. And I think, I mean, even now we have, you know, a healthy kind of gray market in sort of importing electronics from other countries that have, you know, that play, you know, every region of the DVD. You know, I have a Mamitsu at home, you know, or whatever. And we have Make Magazine, which I encourage you all to read, which will teach you how to do those things on your own. he's right. I think that basically what we're seeing is a situation where small innovators, not people at Intel, not people at the big companies, not at Microsoft, will be saying to themselves, wow, I want to create this new thing for streaming my television to my handheld device so that I can watch The Daily Show in the morning on my handheld, right? And the people who are developing that at a small company will say, but wait, you know, I guess we could be inducing infringement because the whole purpose of this device is to stream media from another device and time shift it and maybe watch it, you know, maybe share it then with another device. So it would be hard for them as a small company to want to go to market with that device because they don't have they're trying to develop a market for their device, right? So they don't have an already existing market. They can't afford to take that hit if they're sued by, you know, MGM, if they're sued by Paramount or whatever, they're not going to survive. So they're just simply not going to make that decision to market that device. So I think that's what we're worried about, is the small guy who's invented the cool new streaming thing and or the cool new media sharing thing just saying, I can't do it. I can't risk
it. To put it another way.
He can't afford it.
Rip, mix, burn exists because Apple is paying enough money to the entertainment industry. The moment the entertainment industry says we can make more money by locking Apple out and suing their asses than we make from them paying ITMS and all the legal stuff, Apple's going to be out of the game. The only reason it's because Apple has billions of dollars going to the entertainment industry right now.
I think that that's true. And you notice that they don't have the rip, mix, burn campaign anymore either, you know? So, and I don't think you'd see that campaign anymore now that we have this new inducement standard. I think it's just, it's not going to be possible. So, and in fact, it's even dangerous to say things like, you know, recently Bram Cohen was talking to the press and he said, they asked him about, you know, infringement, and he said, well, I don't give a fuck what people do with BitTorrent, which is a typical Bram thing to say, right? But, you know, I was concerned about that, and he came to visit the EFF offices, and I was saying, you know, dude, don't say that stuff. You have to say, you know, we don't want people infringing. You know, we don't think that's a good thing, because if you say you don't give a fuck, well, that could be like saying that could be construed as inducement, because you're not going out there and saying affirmatively that you don't want it to happen. You're saying, well, you know.
The problem is the parallels of this are basically saying we all have to go in the closet with our technology. And we've already had so many movements of, you know, I came out of the closet as you know, a bisexual man, doing me a lot of favors, just as little. But what it is...
But did you get some when you came out as a peer-to-peer user? So that's the lesson to learn.
I'm not going to go back in the closet on that one. I live in Boston. I'm a geek. I know 4 operating systems, coming on 6. I'm not going to fall back.
Only 6.
I'm working on it. I'm a little nerd. I'm building a NetBSD box. But point is, it's like if we have to suddenly start saying, well, we're not going to be cowboys. This is as close as America gets to cowboys right now, is being able to build stuff. I mean, I pull machines out of dumpsters and make them into servers. If I'm suddenly, if all this is going to lead to that the only thing that's going to exist is retroputing, then the response of, well, we have to retreat, we're going to have to expect that someone's going to say, I don't give a fuck, because deep down, he really doesn't. And if he'd said anything else, he wouldn't mean it. He'd have to be, you know, I mean, we don't get a guy who makes BitTorrent if he isn't, you know, partially limited.
So have we gotten them sufficiently riled up yet for the call to action yet?
Would you like to lead the call to action?
I'm sure it's in your notes somewhere.
No, actually, I don't have a call. I should write down call to action. Randall will handle it.
Oh, great. Well, one of the things...
I
think we're mostly on the same page here. I've heard a lot of variances within it, but it's I think we're expressing what the purpose of this hour and a half together was, which is, this is a concern. If we keep creating case law and brand new laws that suck, like the DMCA, and civil suits that stifle innovation, where will the new innovation come from? To say it'll have to come from overseas, and we'll be playing second fiddle, third fiddle to it. And even worse, they'll be able to do it there, but we won't be able to do it here, even if we see the software and download it. It won't be possible. It won't be legal. That sucks. I've given all of my adult life to software. It makes us all criminals, right? Well, I'll tell you what it's like. you don't want to be there. You don't want to be there. And so what do we do? Where do we go?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I've never been able to understand how, with the DMCA and various DRMs and the circumvention laws, is how they can reconcile that with fair use, with format shifting and making legal copies for your own use.
Well, they're trying to slowly pull away from anything being fair use. They're doing it by technological means. The entertainment industry, and you can probably speak more to this when you get there.
Go ahead.
The entertainment industry really wants to pretend fair use doesn't exist. And so what they say is, well, we're just going to make it really, really, really hard to do fair use, and by that way, then nobody will do it anyway. And they make it more and more illegal to do that. And you're right; it's undermining everything that we've come around to be. It's crazy.
Does everyone know what fair use is? Good. I basically agree with that. I think that in fact you can't reconcile fair use with the DMCA, particularly when every tech company that's dealing with media companies is setting up ways to lock down the media with DRM, because if you circumvent, in order to make fair use of a film, say, you have to circumvent the DRM on it. So even if your fair use copy of the film would be legal under federal copyright law, your circumvention of the DRM on it wouldn't be. So it sets up this kind of catch-22 where you're always breaking the law no matter what. It's funny because Sun recently came out with this controversial new vaporware, which is their DRM, which they called like the Open Commons Media something, or anyway, they used the
source DRM.
It was basically supposed to be open source DRM, which of course defeats the purpose of DRM if it's open source.
And change it, line it 47 from 1 to 2.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, war is peace. There was a lot of controversy about that because, they're basically trying to claim that they're doing this open source thing, and in fact, all they're doing is locking down media. And it's really, I think, part and parcel of this sort of move throughout the tech industry to sort of buy into the DRM game and say, well, if we're going to be working with entertainment companies and we're going to be dealing with any kind of media, well, we better have our own DRM scheme. And that means less fair use for everyone. Unless
so we're
you
never buy anything anymore. We just rent it to a tiny company.
You just license it, or,
Well, that's an interesting argument. If you buy a DVD, do you own the DVD, or don't you? Because if you actually own the DVD, I should be able to copy it, because it's
right.
Now mine. If I don't own it, then if I destroy it accidentally or erase over the top of it, or my brother uses it as a coaster and stuff, then I should be able to call the company up and send me a replacement copy, right? But you can't do either of those.
No.
So you don't really own it, but you don't really not own it either. And this DRM has created this sort of gap in between ownership and licensing.
Well, also, you can't even... go ahead.
Or what if I buy a DVD today? And 15 years from now, DVDs are gone. There's a new version of... I don't know. Holographic movie,
LPs already, though.
Yeah. LPs are basically gone.
But I can tape.
If you own an LP, you can make copies.
It's an open format. When you try and find a record player, a good record player that's not $1,000 because it's built for DJs.
No, I mean, there are programs. Actually, I don't know a whole lot about this because I really don't care about LPs. But if you already own the LPs.
Why do you have to hate LPs?
There are programs where you can use your ownership to get a discount on the CD simply because you already bought the product. And it's supposed to be the same product, only in a better medium. So
cool if that exists. Again.
There is precedent for that. I don't know exactly.
CD or DVD audio, the majority of the stuff that's there now is re-releases of, you know, Herbie Hancock's Headhunters and things that have been out for 30 years. And you're like, oh, let me see what I'm missing. Oh, right. I didn't like this album the first time. God, I'm an idiot.
Yeah, but what about the stuff I bought 15 years ago from independent Company A? Independent Company A doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And I still like that song, but...
Make yourself a nice illegal copy. That's what I've had to do with a lot of my collection. I have a lot of weird, rare albums.
Okay, so what you're telling me is I have to break the law and make an illegal copy of it.
Somebody might own the rights. You know, you might... Thank you. Somebody might own the rights to whatever album it is, and then you could get it from them or whatever movie it is.
They don't have to release it, though. That's
no, they don't. They're under no obligation to do that.
That's what fair use says, or at least alludes to. That's the problem. What we've got is DRM now essentially eliminating all possibilities of what was normally fair use.
That's one of the coolest things about digital media, is once the copies are out there, they're out there. And you can always find somebody who has a copy. You know, like all these films that are gone from Hollywood and are rotting in a basement somewhere and will never be seen again. That won't happen anymore as long as we don't have DRM, because there'll always be copies somewhere. Somebody who's a huge...
I'm fed, and I ask you for copy. You give it to me, and then I arrest you.
That's you asking for a copy. And the thing is, what they're saying is they want a business model. I mean, let's be fair. We're not all completely not law abiders. We here didn't go above the speed limit on the way to Han.
I didn't.
Of course, I wrote part of the speed limit.
I took public transportation.
That was you?
The airplane went like 430, I guess. So.
Before we get off topic, would you either of you like to comment on the fact that in the little blurb here it says that the illegal downloading sites have simply moved overseas? Any comments?
We didn't make that up.
Yeah.
I don't know who wrote that.
Scott wrote that. Where is he?
I mean, left. I suppose that it. I mean, there already is a lot of, you know, peer-to-peer stuff overseas, or sites that, you know, like the Russian sites that'll say like, oh, we can give you a big sandbox full of music for a dollar or whatever. I think that is, sure, I mean, that's definitely going to happen. Although we're also seeing stuff, we were just talking before the panel about the MPA, which is a international version of the MPAA, just announced that they have gotten general warrants in the city of Delhi, India, to go into any house or
business
that they believe contains pirated items. They can go into...
They use the cops,
but they've, in other words, the MPA has gotten these general warrants. And by the way, general warrants are the reason why we have the Fourth Amendment in the U.S. They're completely unlawful. It's basically a warrant to just go anywhere to get anything.
It's getting close, though. Moving wiretaps.
Yeah. We're getting close, but we haven't gotten there yet. But we are using it. We are, of course, using them to protect our intellectual property overseas.
And keep us from having terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's true. Terrorists who steal media.
There's the catch-all, is to fight against terrorism.
That's right. Yeah. The fact that I downloaded the entire season of Doctor Who last year off of BitTorrent makes me a terrorist. Couldn't watch it. I would have watched it on TV if I could have, but, you know.
You're wearing green. You're a terrorist.
It's true.
I don't understand, though. If they broadcast it over the airwaves freely, anyone can watch it.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
I don't understand.
Actually,
hold on. Now, in England, it's not free over the airwaves.
Wait, are you talking about Doctor Who or just TV generally?
Just TV in general. I mean,
radio.
From news broadcasts to...
So the reason why...
We didn't pay a TV license. We didn't pay a TV license, so they have reason to take away...
Well, I know, but he's not just talking about Doctor Who. Although we could talk about Doctor Who, because I like Doctor Who.
It's the right conference, too.
But I would just want to answer your question about why time shifting is troubling for TV, for companies that own TV properties. The reason why the reason why entertainment companies are concerned about people putting TV shows out on peer-to-peer is because it prevents them from making money on reruns, and it prevents them from making money on syndication rights. So if everyone...
They can't put in their little advertisings every 4 or 5 minutes of playtime.
Right, so they lose money on ads, but most importantly, they lose money on the syndication rights because they make a lot of money from reselling the TV show, right? So if you can get every... In other words, so... People can watch the show, but it. What I'm saying is that the reason why they're concerned, I agree with you, of course, it makes no sense. I mean, we all are agreed that it makes no sense. But I'm saying that their rationale is that if I can download, you know, all of Battlestar Galactica from the past year,
just for example,
not that I would do that, because why would I watch that show, even though Starbuck is insanely hot? If I can do that, then if the Sci-Fi Channel can't, in other words, they can, then they say, oh, well, everybody's already downloaded it, already owns the show, you know, essentially, how can we then go ahead and resell to Fox, you know, for syndication?
But that's part of the Betamax decision, was it was okay to time shift, but it was okay to build libraries.
However, yeah. Well, actually, it is okay.
If you go back to the basic tenets of copyright, though, I can say that my voice in here is copyright and nobody can walk out of the room with a tape. That's allowed. Because, but that you're not able to reproduce that.
We're going to figure out the technology to remove that from your brain.
Right, yes.
There's you're going to pay licensing fees on that
memory.
There's
a mind eraser built into the frame of the door. Right. But the point of copyright is that I as a copyright material creator can say this performance or this broadcast still belongs to me even though I have performed it or broadcasted
it. That's right.
So it's up to the copyright holder to say you can't put that on peer-to-peer, and that's what they're arguing against. Now, and the rest of us looking at the other side goes, well, it's stupid for a business model, but that's still their right to choose. If they decided that the right business model was, we'll broadcast it, and by the way, and then you can go ahead and share it all you want because we already broadcast it, that's their right to choose as well. That's what copyright is, the basic tenets of copyright. So it's not up to us as individuals, and here I'm wearing my copyright hat now, it's up to us as individuals to decide that they have a sucky business model. We don't get to decide that. They are the ones that are going to live or die by their business model.
But actually, we can decide it in the sense that we don't have to keep watching. I mean, it's sort of like...
That's true. Yeah.
I only go to artists who I know it's like, you know, here's, you know, you made it yourself, here's the money. Because I know, one, if I'm straight into gas, he's going to be able to go out more, make more music. And two, he's getting much more of the money than I did when I went to, you know, whatever record store. When I go straight up to the dork and go, do a great show, here's some money, try to get home.
And this gets back to why peer-to-peer has to continue to live, because if it is a performance mechanism, if it's a way for independent artists to get their material out, then it needs to exist. And every squeeze by traditional media companies, which is essentially what this is a run by the traditional media companies to control this thing that will take the control away from them. We have to argue against it. We have to stand firm.
And it's interesting because just I think a couple of weeks ago, Sony announced a partnership with an ISP in England called Play Louder. Did you guys hear about this? Basically, anyone who has an account with Play Louder will be able to download any song from the Sony BMI catalog or Sony BMG. I forget what all the BMG. Yes, sorry, BMI is ASCAP. You know, I think. Anyway, so anyone who has an account with this ISP can download any Sony BMG song, and that's just part of the service. So they can download it from any peer-to-peer network in any format, and they're actually working with a company called Audible Magic that has in the past actually worked with entertainment companies to catch people who were sharing infringing material on peer-to-peer networks. They have a huge library huge like hash table basically that measures the fingerprint. I don't actually understand the technology completely, but like they fingerprint the song and they put it into a hash table and then they check each song against their hash table and make sure that it's the actual song from the catalog so that you can then download it. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is that finally the entertainment industry, at least in the music arena, is starting to catch up with the technology and figure out, oh, maybe we should use peer-to-peer kind of like radio. So if you sign up to be part of this ISP, you can just have access to this whole catalog of music. And it's free. You can just, it's part of, you pay the ISP, and part of what you're paying for is having access to all of this music. And that would be ideal.
What's the DRM? Is it portable? I mean, can you burn it?
It's you can download it from anywhere in any format. So you can, yeah, so you can get it in MP3 format if you want. So you can be downloading off BitTorrent, you can be downloading off, you know, eDonkey, eMule, whatever your pleasure is. As long as you're downloading only the music from the Sony BMG catalog.
Well, so what's the incentive for the ISP then, though? Because, I mean, at least here it's been established that they aren't liable for what you do. I mean, it's like the phone company laws where I can't sue Bell South or whoever.
Yeah, they have the safe harbor here.
Right, for someone prank calling me or whatever.
The incentive for the ISP, obviously, is that people will... This is going to be a feature of the ISP now, is that people can sign up and then engage in this downloading.
But I mean, you could engage in it on some other network where it's not legal and the fees are less because they don't have to pay the license fee to Sony.
But then if you get sued by the RIAA, that really sucks ass.
Yeah, illegal things tend to cost money.
Yeah, I mean, having talked to like hundreds of people who have had to pay like $8,000 or $10,000.
Illegal stuff has all kinds of problems.
Yeah, it's really, yeah, we don't like illegal stuff.
So,
files in different formats.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea is that, yeah, the incentive is the ISP gets to offer this service that people want. Users like it because they can download their favorite music without worrying that they're going to get sued.
Well, it sounds like a good adaptation of the whole technology. You know, they're getting away from the dinosaur.
One of the big issues
he's been waiting,
at least I've seen, is that much of the, and there was an article on this in, I think, Wired the other day, the tagline for it was public domain dead in 35 years, which is kind of terrifying. But one of the issues I see is that less things are going into the public domain today, that the affectionately named Disney decisions on copyright
Mickey Mouse
allowed
decision.
The mouse to take yes. over copyright and is spilling over throughout. And I don't think that DRM or any of the other the rights managements today would actually be a problem if things made it into the public domain, you know, in a reasonable time period. I mean, right now it's at minimum 130 years, I think, if you're lucky. Like, the author dies, you extend it for 50 or 60 years past that.
Mm-hmm.
Person,
yeah,
person
70 past dead.
70 past dead, so yeah, I mean, you're looking at
so basically things made
years.
Before 1923 are in the public domain.
Right. But less things are going to be going in the public domain as I get older, as many of us get older. Has the EFF or anyone else attempted to come up with an effective strategy to try to overturn those laws as basically being a complete, you know, assault on what copyright was meant to be, on what the public domain was meant to be?
Well, people are, definitely. I mean, certainly Lawrence Lessig has done his best to try to challenge the copyright extension, and unfortunately the Supreme Court was not sympathetic to his argument. And he also has founded the nonprofit organization Creative Commons, which offers a suite of licenses to people, copyright licenses, which are some rights reserved licenses as opposed to all rights reserved. So you can make your art available, you can make your writing available, your software available under a license that says, feel free to copy this, you don't need to ask permission as long as you credit me as the author, or as long as you don't create a derivative work.
Or non-commercial.
Or as long as it's non-commercial. So there are alternatives, and a lot of people are, in fact, releasing their work under Creative Commons licenses of that.
I've taken every talk that I give that's under an hour and taken the entire slides and put them under Creative Commons non-commercial because I want people to have access to those slides, and it's a great place to publish it. And I put it up on ourmedia.org, and that's been a really good asset as well.
Yeah, I have a book coming out next year from Duke University Press, and I was the first author of theirs to insist on a Creative Commons license. And it took some doing, but it's an attribution non-commercial license, which means feel free to copy the entire book for non-commercial purposes as long as you attribute it to me as the author. And so please do. the book is about monster movies. Yes, look for it next year. I think it will be out in April. Yeah, tell us the Felon story.
Well, let's see. There's a short version. I've given this talk pretty much every year for the last 4 years here, so if you've heard it already, go blah, blah, blah for about the next... I'm just going to give you the two-and-a-half-minute version. Yeah, the two-and-a-half-minute version, because the first time I gave it was an hour and a half. I'm not going to go anywhere near that, except in the introduction, apparently, now. I worked at Intel for 5 years as a system administrator, and during my period there, I did typical system administrator things in charge of a small group of 30 engineers, basically building the first mega transistor chip that they did. No, giga? There was. Hit a new scale for miniaturization for Intel. And through a disagreement with my boss, I got fired from one project and walked right across the hallway and got another gig somewhere else. And so I was still at Intel, so it was like 3 years here and then maybe 6 months to a year there. I had been a beta tester for the Crack software, which takes a password file and reverse engineers it by brute force, tries every possible combination until it finds the ones that actually hit. And I realized that a new version of Crack had come out and I hadn't played with it yet. And the group that I was in at the time was just the five engineers that were managing all the networks for 3,000 of the engineers in one facility, and I said, well, I can run Crack against that, but it's just me and my four buddies. There's probably not a lot of test for that. Well, I still had access to the old network, and I still had access to the 480 password file that was still there. So I ran Crack against that, full out in the open, thought I was just basically testing Crack, and if I came up with any data, I could use that to sort of show the former boss that I worked for in the old group that I was still, you know, I still had something to show. As a contractor, you spend a lot of time, you know, demonstrating that you do things above and beyond the call of duty, so they rehire you. That's part of the thing. You're constantly under evaluation, constantly under the possibility of a contract being canceled. So that's one of the things I was working on. Well, it turned out that 48 out of the 600 passwords were guessable. What I didn't know at the time, because all I saw was these 48 passwords, I went, darn it, you know, I was running Crack back when I was there. They've obviously stopped doing it. I got to tell their bosses, but I was preparing a report on and figuring out who exactly to tell within the organization then that these guys weren't still doing their job. What I didn't realize was two of the passwords were, one of them belonged to the senior engineering manager of the organization at the time, and the other one belonged to the vice president, whose password was president with the S changed to a dollar sign. Well, so I didn't realize this. I just simply saw 48 passwords and went, yuck, and I was preparing the report, getting ready to tell it, when a guy in my new organization saw this run in plain sight and without asking me, immediately went to Intel Security and said, we've got a spy here. Intel Security went to the cops. I had a search warrant delivered at my house. They took all my stuff. And a year and a half later, I was convicted of three felonies for essentially being overenthusiastic about my job. And I had 480 hours of community service, $67,000 of restitution, 5 years probation, a 3 month jail sentence that was deferred 3 years, eventually pulled back off for exemplary community service. That was pretty cool. And I'm a felon for life because it's three felonies, it'll never be expunged. And I've taken this all the way up to the Oregon Supreme Court on various issues all the way through. My contention is that the Oregon computer crime law is overbroad and vague. Any unauthorized alteration of a computer is a Class C felony without any kind of cutout for any kind of defense on any one of those levels. So if I hand you my cell phone, yeah, like that, and I push the reset button or something, or even just change the color of the screen, that's a felony in Oregon. $100,000, 5 years in jail. And there's very similar laws across most of the states, and I was convicted essentially under a bad law. And there have been subsequent cases as well that have been prosecuted under the same law. My case made bad case law to start with, but for example, there was a lady in Eugene, Oregon, Southern Oregon, who stole from the cash register. And this normally wouldn't have even gotten to the threshold of even being a felony. It was like $25. But she reset the tape counter. They made that a felony. So they didn't even prosecute her on the $25 she took out. They made a felony because she reset the cash register. And it sucks.
Yeah.
That's the short version.
Gotten a lot better at that.
Yeah. Lots of practice.
So do you see things like that happening to people under the new induce law?
What I see about lawmakers, I'm not going to paint lawmakers with a completely broad sweep. What I see the lawmakers doing is really wanting to protect us, or at some level of us, and for some various of protection. But they're really trying to protect and do the right thing. But they're lied to. Can I say that out loud? Probably. They're lied to by people that have the most vested interest. And this is sort of a tradition in our system over the years. But now, because of the expense of getting elected to Congress, the only people that sort of get the audience that the common man used to get 50 and 100 years ago are the people that are running big business. So big business and the lobbyists are controlling the laws being put in place. The legislatures are getting lied to and either blindly or openly are saying, okay, I'll write laws that help you out and will look like it's being the right law, but we'll make it so broad, we'll let the courts duke it out. You know, and the little guy is going to get caught every time, caught in the sense of getting caught in the machinery, not just caught like, you know, observed doing something. But yeah, it's sad, so that's what I see happening here with this case. It's going to make the little guy, you know, take it up the hiney again on the stuff they're doing.
To be fair, though, on behalf of the Supreme Court justices and a lot of them, I mean, we're dealing with people who did not grow up in a computer age. Now, I'm guessing that in a joint like this, a majority of us have been dealing with computers for a long time. We're a little bit familiar. These are guys who, I mean, like, for example, they're more like my father. My father is an appellate lawyer. It's what he does. You know, if you kill a couple people, you want him. He has done capital cases. He will get you off. You'll be fine. But you put a computer in front of him, and he'll be like, where's the secretary that goes with it? Like, no. You do use it yourself. I don't know how to type. So you're taking people. It's not just a question of they're being lied to. They're being lied to because no one has made a crash course for...
EFF comes in and stuff.
We haven't made a crash course for judges on here's what you do in front of these crazy computer things. Now, as much as it seems like the idea of this use that we all go through every day and we see this as crazy, they're not exposed to this because they don't have a reason to be involved in that aspect.
But there's already a mechanism.
That's what they have clerks for, though.
There's already a mechanism. Yeah.
They don't deal with. They're not farmers. They don't make.
There's already a mechanism in place. Friends of the Court briefs and the structure. I mean, they've been handing down laws and case law for centuries, for as long as we've been around, about issues they don't understand. The point is to have the right people tell them the right things. And this case, as far as I could tell, was you know, the right things tried to happen, and we still got a bad law.
Yeah, I don't think it has to do with not understanding the technology. I think there are some court rulings that have come down that do reflect a poor understanding of technology. But I think in this case, the Supreme Court justices were very clear on what was going on. They understood that this was about business models. They understood, you know, at one point Scalia asked very specifically about how this would fit into a Xerox machine. He said, you know, look, if we, you know, rule that, you know, if we somehow repeal Sony, you know, what would this do to the Xerox machine? So, you know, they understand that this is about, you know, people trying to develop new technologies and the kinds of limitations that will be placed on new technologies by the law. So I don't think there's any kind of, you know, brain dump that we could give the justices that would have necessarily changed the decision. I'm sorry? Yeah, well, actually, it is. Xerox has been, it's come into common usage now. So you are allowed to use the term Xerox as well as the term Kleenex, and you're not committing trademark violation. But it is a good analogy, actually. And I think the reason why it was a good analogy partly has to do with the business model for the Xerox copier, because it was a technology that could be used for infringement, but did have non-infringing uses. And so I think that was why it was, and also, you know, I mean, it's something that, that they've all used. They're, you know, they probably all come out of the law, and so they've done a lot of Xeroxing.
Partially, it's also valuable as not an analogy. I mean, it's a perfectly legitimate question to say, will everybody have to scrap their photocopiers everywhere if we make this ruling?
Yeah, and that was exactly his question. Yeah. And you know, it's a good question, because what do people use Xerox machines for?
Sure looks like that's
we'll have to offshore all of our Xeroxing.
having
email it, send it back.
Having worked.
How far you want to take that, though?
Yeah.
Because anything from a camera phone to regular digital cameras,
mm-hmm.
old style cameras, all going all the way back to like 1940 something, all of them can more or less be, you know, hold it up just like this, and it works just like a photocopier.
Yeah. Scribes. We'd have to go back and kill all the scribes. All the monks.
Mm-hmm. They're inducing infringement.
Yes.
Yeah. Going back to what Randall said about legislators, though, I turned my name tag around for a reason. Having worked in the Georgia State Senate for a senator of fairly well repute, I can say that some of the senators are very well informed. Some of the House members are as well. However, there is a lot of resistance that the first words you hear out of somebody's mouth is, how do we sell this? And they don't mean, how do I tell people, like average citizens, you and I, what they should say to them to get them to be aligned with the law. They literally mean, how do we make a business model out of this? How do we keep the capitalist engine of the United States running full steam? And I know from personal experience, there is an incredible amount of resistance to keeping the status quo where it is, to keeping the RIAA where they are, to keeping the MPAA where they are. And I worry about where you were going when you said that a lot of our congressional members are, I mean, the amount of money required to get into Congress now, even into state legislature, is ridiculous now. It's almost pandemic at this point, I believe, on certain levels. Do you see that sort of resistance these days, you know, that they really just want to keep the machine running, and they don't, the cost to the public, the cost to all of us, to basically keep things the way they are and just going straight ahead full steam and damn the consequences. Do you see that as being part of the problem today?
15 minutes.
I think you're right. I think there's a fairly, I wouldn't say wide variety of opinions in Congress, but there is a range, and I don't think everybody wants to be going full steam ahead exactly the same way. I mean, Boucher has proposed a bill that would take the fangs out of the DMCA. It's a DMCA reform bill that would actually allow for circumvention of copy protection in order to do. Fair use, in order to make fair use of your technology, in order to conduct research, in order to do reverse engineering to make your technology interoperable with other kinds of tech or other applications. So, I mean, I think there are Congress critters who are interested. I'm sorry, I'm borrowing the term from Declan McCullough. I don't think that we have kind of a uniform Congress where, especially on technology issues, because they don't necessarily split along traditional party lines, you know, technological innovation is a very pro-capitalist, pro-money-making enterprise. It's a pro-America kind of thing, keep us on top, that sort of thing. So I don't think that's the only problem. I think that Congress is one problem. I think the courts are one problem. I think the FCC is a problem. That's a whole other can of worms. So I really think that in order for us to fight back, as we were attempting to do about 20 minutes ago, I think it has to be, there has to be, the problems have to be dealt with at a number of levels, politically, also legally, also just in terms of consumer activism. How is that for a waffly answer to your question?
I think we know. I think that's part of the problem is that I'm looking at this sort of mystified, going a deer in headlights style. Like I want to do something and I don't know really where to go next. So
I think there are concrete steps that people can take. I think one is definitely to be, active in terms of knowing what your congressperson is doing with technology-related legislation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of organizations that work on that specific issue. Certainly EFF is one. But also in Washington, D.C., there's the Electronic Privacy Information Center that deals with privacy issues. There's Public Knowledge, which deals with the kinds of issues we're talking about here with peer-to-peer and intellectual property and copyright. There's the Center for Democracy and Technology, which does a lot of lobbying and a lot of working with folks in Congress. The other thing you can be doing, though, is really plain old grassroots activism, you know, making sure that there is free software that provides an alternative to what corporations are handing out, you know, contributing to open source projects, contributing to public knowledge about how they how people can make fair use of their media using whatever tools you can provide them with. This is not a battle that we've lost. It's definitely something that we're still fighting. Certainly at EFF, we're still fighting. We're always looking for new cases. If you're in a situation where your company is being threatened under these new induce rules, get in touch with us. If you're designing a piece of technology and you're worried about how things will pan out legally, definitely get in touch with us. We talk all the time to small companies that are building technology that they're concerned may cause them to run afoul of the laws. And if there's a problem, we work pro bono. We can set people up with other lawyers that work pro bono in other states. And so we're very committed to making sure that this law does not harm innovation.
The Small Business Administration also does similar things.
Yeah, absolutely. And the FTC can sometimes help you too.
Unless you're a felon.
Unless you're a felon. In which case, EFF helps you.
I just changed my friends as of 10 years ago. Last few minutes for questions, please. We stunned them all.
How about, what if you abstract at one more level and say, instead of creating an application that induces infringement, you're creating a toolkit for creating these applications, like how people are writing P2P apps in 9 lines of Python or 6 lines of Perl.
Mm-hmm. So like Larry Wall goes to jail.
Right, exactly.
Oh my God, no!
No! Rescue Larry!
He didn't do anything to prevent people from writing those apps.
I think that, I don't know how that would work out. That's an interesting question. I don't know if like development environments or toolkits would, I think it's just, it's the application itself.
We could get there though down the slippery slope. If
yeah,
they start digging
it is
out
an
apps
interesting
and
question.
All the apps start using the same core software, then mm-hmm. they might go next after the whoever's using the
yeah,
core software.
Yeah, Python I think is going to be the big target.
Yeah.
What did you say about Mozilla and Internet Explorer a couple of days ago?
What?
It was on Slashdot.
I can't be right then.
No, we can't hate Slashdot. No hating on Slashdot.
But if it was on Wikipedia, it would be correct.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, revision history. What was the story?
Yeah.
The story was law enforcement would go in and were having problems because they're using Firefox or instead of Internet Explorer, the patrol officer doesn't know where the cache is to look and see if the guy.
Yeah, I think if I can sum up for you, the basic issue is that all the law enforcement people have very good understanding of Windows and IE, and so they can run their forensic tools to see what you've been visiting if you're running Windows and IE. But if you're using Firefox or Linux, they don't know where everything is. They don't have tools that run under that. So the implication was that you're automatically a bad guy because you're running Firefox or more Linux.
Yeah, that's great.
only terrorists use Linux.
Yeah, it's true.
It's well, where it's
going
to go.
I don't know if you guys know about this, but the Cuban government is actually now finally considering the switch to Linux.
Oh,
so I think,
again.
Yeah, commies are using Linux.
Damn
so,
commies.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
We're not sure, no.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, actually, commies aren't our enemy anymore, so maybe it's good. Yeah, actually, when I was in Cuba a couple of years ago, I was talking to some scientists there, and I said, well, so how come you guys aren't using Linux? Why don't you want to use, you know, free software? And the guy I was talking to said, oh, yeah, well, we use free software. We use Windows. Okay.
Free as in share.
Yeah, free as in beer.
Yes, right.
Or free as in Windows.
That's right.
So, are there any final?
Okay, about 2 minutes.
This has to be super final.
Have you heard anything about a peer-to-peer web browser so that nobody gets farked or slash dotted anymore? I mean, have you heard about that?
Peer-to-peer.
I do not know about a peer-to-peer web browser.
I heard about somebody kicking around an idea for like a Firefox plugin or something where you can just basically you post a tracker instead of a web page.
There's a mod for Apache that does that.
Apache.
Yeah, it's like mod BitTorrent, I think.
If that happens, and you know, Microsoft has this thing where they want to be compatible with everything, right? So they'd have to eventually incorporate that, and then Internet Explorer would be technically
Microsoft BitTorrent?
Yeah, basically.
Microsoft Donkey.
So this is a panel on the future of peer-to-peer. That could be one possible future. I mean, I really do think that this thing with Sony cutting a deal with an ISP is sort of the future of peer-to-peer. We're going to see corporate peer-to-peer because it's a powerful technology. I mean, it's obviously the next step for all kinds of applications, not just for media sharing, but for all kinds of other stuff too. So yeah, I think we're going to see an increasing sort of permeable membrane between corporate interests and peer-to-peer applications. So then we'll see what the next revolutionary thing will be.
I think it's important, though. I think what you've seen in the last hour and a half, if I can summarize that, is that it's an important issue. It's an issue that the conversation has to stay alive. It will affect all of us one way or the other eventually, I think, if not already. So the important thing is to keep the conversation alive and find all the places, you know, look at the EFF website, look at the other websites that were listed there. And
keep hacking.
And keep writing the software so that it's around, even if it's illegal.
Yeah. And I have another panel tonight at 10 on how sex is changing technology. So if you want to come back and talk about sex, do that at 10 tonight.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you.